Coming up, People Rise Up, featuring a conversation regarding what's collectively been known as the British Briefing Papers, with David McMichael. Good morning to you. You are listening to People Rise Up on KBOO here in Portland. My name is Andrew Geller, and I need to let you know that this program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and by the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media, and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org. So welcome. This morning, I'm going to be talking about something that it's not like it got lost in the shuffle of stuff that wasn't important, but it's not exactly new news either, and hopefully it's not new news to any of you folks, although there's been developments that you may not know about. What I'm referring to are a series of memos that have surfaced over the past 6 weeks, May 1st being the first revelation in the Sunday Times, regarding meetings between the British and U.S. governments in early to mid 2002 regarding preparations to invade Iraq. And how what's in those memos differs from the public explanation given for those months and following months, and possibly even some still to this day. And joining me to shed some further light on what these memos mean, I have David McMichael. He works with Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and I'm very pleased to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Andrew. I hope I can contribute to a little more understanding of this.
I'm sure we all do. Now, just initially, if you could take about a minute or so to sort of explain your background and, you know, why you're here to talk about these intelligence memoranda.
Okay, Andrew. Well, most pertinently, I was in the early 1980s. I was at the National Intelligence Council, a CIA officer there, a senior estimates officer, as I was called, with responsibilities for the Western Hemisphere. And at that time, as you know, this all led up to the Iran-Contra scandal, or Contra policy in Nicaragua, where continually I was finding no evidence to support the administration's position and rationalization of that, and eventually left the agency. And in 1985, after some private travel and investigation down in Central America, I made myself even more unpopular by testifying against the United States at the Hague trial in 1985, Nicaragua versus the United States. And after that, helped organize a group of former intelligence officers called the Association of National Security Alumni. And as their Washington representative for some years, edited and published a magazine called Unclassified. And I'd been sort of out of the loop for a while until this Iraq thing began, and then I was contacted by, again, by former CIA officers, particularly Ray McGovern, who is the moving figure in veteran intelligence professionals for Sanity. We were concerned about the misuse of intelligence leading up to this, and have been very active, you know, in exposing what we believe are the abuses of the intelligence system. And in fact, as the we're getting toward the point of what we're going to discuss today, the way information is presented and misrepresented, if you will, to the public to justify particular actions.
Now, as I mentioned, the memoranda, actually it was initially just one memo, July 23rd of 2002, that was publicized in a May 1st Sunday London Times article. That's become to be known as the Downing Street Memo. 10 Downing Street is the sort of the seat of government. And since May 1st, there have been five or six additional memos that have been made public. And the really fascinating thing about those memos that were released later is they're all from March of 2002, four months before the so-called Downing Street memo. And, you know, in that it was the first one publicized, it's important that the so-called Downing Street memo is out. But it's really those earlier papers, which I'm going to collectively refer to as the British briefing papers on Iraq. And it's those March papers that, to me, are even more damning, because they not only show that they basically just reinforce what was evident in the so-called Downing Street memo. Why don't you briefly summarize the thrust of what these papers show regarding U.S. in particular positions on Iraq back at that time?
Okay, this is these series of memoranda are all date from March, when the British government was negotiating, as it will, with the with the United States about what policy to take in view of the U.S. determination for invading Iraq. And I think we can even go back a little further on this for some background. As we know from public statements made by the original Treasury Secretary in the first Bush administration, Paul O'Neill, at the very first Bush cabinet meeting in January of 2001, Bush raised the issue of invading Iraq. And then, of course, post 9/11, Bush, as we know from the counterterrorism director Richard Clark, Bush pulled Clark aside and told him to establish links between Al Qaeda and Iraq, including something to demonstrate that Iraq had participated in or supported the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the 9/11. So the movement was on already, and of course this was being coordinated with our close ally, Great Britain. Now, these subsequent memoranda, as I say, detail the visits of the British Defense, Intelligence, and high diplomatic officials, meetings with counterparts in the United States, who were Paul Wolfowitz, George Tenet, Condoleezza Rice, are all named in these things, and all of whom note that the United States was determined to go to war with Iraq. So we have among these documents, which now have been released, the UK Foreign Office memo of March 8th, 2002, giving the legal background on this. And in the memo, it said that the United States maintains an assessment United Nations resolutions is for the individual member states to determine and then act on. And in the quote from the memo, it says, "We are not aware of any other state, which supports this view." Then on the 14th of March, Donald Manning, the foreign policy advisor to Blair, met with Condoleezza Rice and reported that Rice is enthusiastic for regime change. But as David Manning says, Bush has yet to answer the big question: what happens on the morning after? Then on the 16th of March, the UK ambassador, Christopher Meyer, in Washington, met with Paul Wolfowitz. And he said that we told Wolfowitz we back regime change, but the plan had to be clever because it would be a tough sell in the United Kingdom and even tougher in Europe. And the need, he said, was to, and I'm quoting here, to wrong foot Saddam on inspections and United Nations Security Council resolutions. In other words, the point was to devise a strategy in which Saddam would be shown to be opposed to inspections or that he was violating United Nations Security resolutions. Then finally, on the 22nd of March, the United Kingdom's Foreign Office reported to the Foreign Secretary, Jack Straw, that, and this is the quote from that memorandum, regime change doesn't stack up. Mm-hmm. And they said that it sounds like Bush has a grudge against Saddam. It would be much better, they said, as you have suggested, to make the objective ending a threat to international security from Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. Then Straw, the foreign secretary, wrote to Blair, "We have to answer the big question. What will an invasion achieve? There's no U.S. assessment that has answered satisfactorily how that regime change is to be secured or whether the replacement regime will be any better." So those were the, and in addition to that, of course, we have in August of 2002, Straw met with Powell in Long Island, then Secretary of State Powell, to present the United Kingdom plan, in which Straw emphasized that the United States and UK must go to the UN to demand that the inspectors go back in, and in the hope that Iraq would refuse, and that would be the cause of war. Then in September of 2002, President Bush did go to make his speech to the United Nations and said that the United States would work with the Security Council for necessary resolutions. And then finally, to complete this series of events, in November of 2002, the Security Council Resolution 1441, which called for the readmission of inspectors, passed unanimously, even with Assyria voting for it. But every state, especially the United Kingdom, its representative, Ambassador Greenstock, stated that there was no automaticity to this. In other words, a second resolution on military force was absolutely necessary. Well, I'll stop there, but the background will show you that from the earliest days of the Bush administration, the idea of waging war against Iraq was being very seriously discussed, and that in the aftermath of 9/11, an opportunity was seen to do that. And we know, of course, from revelations about statements made at cabinet meetings and other high-level meetings in the Bush administration, they're very determined to show a link between Iraq and the World Trade Center bombings. As you recall, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld argued that it would be better not to attack Afghanistan, but to attack Iraq because there were many more targets there. So let's just say what these various British memoranda do is provide confirmation of this determination to go to war. And as the July 23rd memorandum said, it was necessary because the case was thin, I'm quoting, to fix the facts around the policy. And that's another quote. So there I'll stop.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO in Portland. My guest today is David McMichael, who works with Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. And you can find out more about this program and links to the documents we're referring to by going to the People Rise Up website at www.kboo.fm. Now, I want to just back up for a minute here and share some information that I pulled out of the various memos, the March 8th, 14th, 18th, and 22nd here, that I think are just worth mentioning in specific because they lead into where we're going next here. Okay, so the March 8th memo, and this is the earliest one that has been released. Quoting, "A legal justification for invasion would be needed. None currently exists." 2 pages later, "Washington believes the legal basis for an attack on Iraq already exists." 4 pages later, "Regime change has no basis in international law." 1 page later, "No recent evidence of Iraq complicity with international terrorism. There is therefore no justification for action against Iraq based on action in self-defense." Now, going to the David Manning memo from the 14th, he writes regarding two of his meetings with Condoleezza Rice, actually. Quote, "I think there is a real risk that the administration underestimates the difficulties." And in that, referring to following the initial assumed defeat of the Iraq military. And then on the March 22nd memo, quoting, "U.S. scrambling to establish a link between Iraq al-Qaeda is so far, frankly, unconvincing." And then as one of the so-called famous lines from the so-called Downing Street memo, the July 23rd, 2002 memo, pointed to the fact that the United States was working to fix the intelligence around the policy. Now, that sort of idea has outraged at least one continually courageous man. That's John Conyers, who's a Democrat from Michigan. 4 days after the London Sunday Times story broke, he sent a letter to George W. Bush in official capacity as a congressperson asking several questions, fairly basic questions, but several, regarding the London Sunday Times article. And this doesn't include any of these other memos that we're discussing here now. Something like 90 or so congresspeople have signed on to this letter demanding answers. There have been over 500,000 people, myself included, who have signed.
And me too.
Good. And hopefully many of you listeners. And there's links to do that if you haven't already at the People Rise Up website. But several hundreds of thousands of people have signed on to this letter. They were shooting, I think, initially for like 50,000, and it just ballooned, and it seems like it could hit 1 million by tomorrow when John Conyers is holding an unofficial hearing because the Senate, the House Judiciary won't allow them to hold an official hearing, an unofficial hearing on this matter. You mentioned Ray McGovern earlier. Ray's going to be testifying at that. Obviously, Conyers will be leading it. In the fact that this is an unofficial hearing, what do you think can be accomplished from something that's not going to get entered into the record and is not going to be paid attention to in any regard by the dominant party on the committee?
Yeah, well, this, Andrew, really goes to the heart of the matter here, as you may or may not know, late news today.
Is this about the room?
The Democratic Party in Wisconsin was holding its annual meeting and has voted a resolution calling on impeachment proceedings against George Bush, Richard Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld to go forward.
Well, God, it's about time. I mean, for all...
Well, I recall back one of my personal heroes, the late Henry B. Gonzalez of Texas, introduced similar resolutions twice during the Iran-Contra period and was almost totally ignored, but that's the way it is, because as you and the listeners all well know, is impeachment is a purely legislative proceeding, and if you don't have the a majority in the House of Representatives to pass a bill of impeachment, you're not going to get one. And since up to now there have been no stains on dresses
introduced
into the evidence, it seems doubtful that anybody will go forward on this. But it's important that the issue is raised. Yes, it is. And Conyers meeting tomorrow, as you say, I think there are now 94 and maybe as many as 100 members of Congress who have signed on his letter. Following the hearings, which begin at 2:30 on tomorrow in East Coast time in Washington, Conyers, the members of Congress who signed the letter, so forth, and many others will be at a rally in Lafayette Park at 5 o'clock, and from there, they will march with the letter to the White House to deliver it by hand. So this may attract some major news media attention, and I hope it gets the attention it deserves, because it's very serious business.
Now, something I haven't heard anyone here in the States talk about is, and this is a yet sort of a thing, because the article is just out as of, I guess it was Sunday. Again, Lunday Sunday Times, Michael Smith, the guy that broke the May 1st Downing Street memo story. This article is entitled "The Leak That Changed Minds on the Iraq War," and I'll put a link to this on my website as well. About two-thirds of the way down, he's leading into a discussion about the U.S. beginning to, "But as Jeff Hoon, then British Defense Secretary, said in that Downing Street meeting in July 2002, the, quote, U.S. had already begun spikes of activity to put pressure on the regime," end quote. Now, I don't know if you've seen this article, and I'm going to continue reading in a moment, but as a former CIA officer and someone who's been in the Marines for a long time, what does the phrase spikes of activity in this context imply?
Well, you know, I'd have a hard time, answering that question. Spikes of activity, of course. I think what one could refer to here is, as you know, during the whole period from the end of the Gulf War in 1991 until the invasion in March of 2003, the United States and the United Kingdom were carrying out flights over what they called the no-fly zones in northern and southern Iraq, in which no Iraqi aircraft were allowed to fly, even though it was their national airspace. And in part of that was to carry out attacks against Iraqi air defense installations.
Okay, let me actually interrupt you right there, because that's exactly what I was wondering if you were going to mention. So back to Michael Smith's June 12 article, quote, "No," and this is exactly the next sentence from where I previously left off. "No bombs were dropped on southern Iraq in March 2002, but by July, with the, quote, spikes of activity in full flow, about 10 tons of bombs were being dropped a month, the same month the Downing Street memo was generated in." Back to the article. "The problem was that the Iraqis didn't retaliate. They didn't provide the excuse Bush and Blair needed."
That's right.
"So at the end of August, the Allies started the air war anyway. the number of bombs dropped on southern Iraq shot up to 54.6 tons in September 2002 alone. The authenticity of these figures is not in doubt. They were obtained from the government by parliamentary questions put by the Liberal Democrats, so they're up on the Hansard website for all the internet bloggers to see. They show that Bush and Blair began their war not in March 2003, as most believed, but at the end of August 2002, 6 weeks before Bush received his congressional backing and more than 2 months before the United Nations vote.
Well, that's very true. And another part of the spikes of activity, which have not been publicized, and I really couldn't verify these, through documents, but we very definitely had special forces teams and Delta Force teams, which are, special operations groups in the United States Army, inside Iraq.
Probably not long after 9/11.
One action or another. And then, of course, you have at the same time, including spikes of activity, was the buildup of United States forces in Qatar and Kuwait and on Diego Garcia. All of these preparations were being made. And I think the very good point to make, of course, is that in all of this, when you mentioned the congressional resolution, is the fact that in October of 2002, the Congress was persuaded, and I'm sure it didn't take much persuasion, to write the blank check, the modern equivalent of the Tonkin Gulf resolution, authorizing the President of the United States to commit U.S. armed forces at his discretion in Iraq.
So at this point, I suppose, if you're not getting to D.C. for the rally and to directly physically support John Conyers' effort, it seems like the thing to do is, if nothing else and you have internet access, put your name on the letter. It's simple. It takes next to no time. People Rise Up website has a quick link for you to be able to do that simply. And secondly, I forget the name of the website. I put a link up about daily action items targeting media. There's a website out there that is got names, phone numbers, and emails of specific people at different media outlets, and they're switching them every single day. So contacting media, talking to people, make copies of these British briefing papers. It's maybe 25 pages tops. Simple reading. You can do it. You can read all of these memos. They're pretty easy to understand. You can gloss over the parts that are complex. And I loved this quote, and I don't have it in front of me right now, but when asked earlier this week about this, when Bush and Blair were meeting in Washington.
June 10th.
Yeah, so it was in the past week. When asked if he'd read the memo, Bush said he had read a characterization of the memo. And I thought, the memo's like 4 pages. Why can't this guy read the memo itself? Anyway.
He also said it was the furthest thing from the truth.
He would know.
The truth,
that's right.
Mr. Blair jumped in quickly, of course, to say that absolutely wrong, no decisions had been made. And another point to referring to that press conference is that Mr. Bush was quick to state that this should be discredited because it had been leaked in the middle of the British election campaign.
Yeah,
that had to do with its authenticity, I don't know.
Right.
It certainly affected the Blair's majority in the parliament.
And neither government has officially challenged its authenticity.
As a matter of fact, the British government has confirmed the authenticity of at least the July 23rd memo.
Right. Well, David McMichael, thank you very much for joining me this morning to talk about the British briefing papers. David McMichael works with Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and take care.
Okay, thanks a lot, and my regards to all my friends in Portland.
That does it on time. You can check the website, People Rise Up, in the KBOO schedule at kboo.fm. There's some links up. More will be up. Check out the British briefing papers. You can contact me via email, if you like, at kboo@riseup.net. You can also send postal mail here, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. And I do appreciate hearing from listeners. Thank you very much for listening.